This is the Larry Mueller Show, and I'm Jill Nadeau, filling in for Larry today. In the studio with me is Michael Riley. He's a third-generation Madison attorney and a partner in the Axley Law Firm. Now, last time Mike was with us, we had a lot of questions about insurance, so we thought we'd tackle the subject again, but Mike can also answer your general legal questions. We're not limiting our discussion to insurance. So what would you like to ask Mike? Join the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on our Facebook page. And just a reminder, our discussion today is intended as general information and should not be relied on or construed as legal advice. Mike, thanks so much for coming back in today.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here.
We had a real popular topic last time.
It was a great show, a lot of fun.
Really? Now, I think there are probably very few people who would say that shopping for insurance is fun. What's really the best way to go about it?
Well, you know, there are a lot of different ways, but to begin with, shopping is really the key, because I think it's something that for many of us, we get an insurance policy and we keep that insurance policy for life or
right.
close to life, unless maybe we have a bad claim experience or something happens to change our circumstances dramatically. But I think we should go out and actually see if we can find good coverage for less money. You know, we see these ads constantly where they say people who switch save, you know, and but just about every insurance company runs those ads.
Yes.
And they can run the ads because the fact is that's why people switch. So if you're going from a company to State Farm, if you're going to Progressive, wherever you're going, likely you're doing that to save money. And that is a big consideration. It's not the only one, but it is a very big consideration. So you can buy insurance nowadays, obviously, in a lot of ways. You can certainly buy it online the way we buy so many other things. But if you're going to go through an agent, which is the way probably most of us buy insurance, you can either buy it through an agent that's called a captive agent for instance, American Family or State Farm, who generally sell through their own agents. Or you can buy it through an independent agent who represents a number of companies, not an endless variety, but a number of companies. And I think it's worth exploring both. I think you want to go and see what can they do for you? Because companies underwrite risks, which simply means they try to price their policy based on their perception of the risk they're taking on. And all companies don't look at that the same, which is why sometimes you can save money by going to another company.
Sure.
So, you know, go to two or three or four companies for that matter. Go to an independent agent and ask them to get you bids and see what they can do for you. If you, you know, you like a particular company like State Farm or American Family or a number of others that write directly through their own agents, talk to one of their agents. The downside to me to buying directly, and if you think you can get a great policy that way, certainly worth exploring. I wouldn't ever tell someone not to do that. Having an agent helps in a couple ways. One, a good agent at least will talk to you about what you really need and what kind of coverage you ought to have. And you're not necessarily going to get that online or on a phone call to somebody. The second thing is, agents don't matter as much to companies as they used to. It used to be if you were really good insured and you had a loss and you went to your agent and said, gee, they're not really helping me here. Can you help me out? The agent would often try to do it and could actually weigh in and maybe not change everything, but at least could be of help. My experience has been that there's less of that now than there was 10, 15, 20 years ago. Companies are, you know, as most businesses are nowadays, are very profit-driven. And if they take a position on a loss, the claims people and the marketing people are in different wings and they don't talk to one another. So, you know, it isn't as if the agent can simply go to bat. But the fact is, a good agent can help you in a lot of ways, including helping you pick the right kind of insurance for you and the right kind of coverage for you. So I think it's worth exploring that.
Okay. And now you said you should shop around when you need to find new insurance. How do you know it's time to look?
You know, in all honesty, I think any time you renew your policy, it's time to at least check. A lot of us, myself included, I have changed a few times over the years, but I've been very prone to be with one company and to stay with that company for a long period of time. And frankly, somebody who should know better, I don't necessarily go out and do the checking I really probably ought to do to see what am I getting? Is it the right coverage for me? And specifically, you know, is it the right price? I mean, can I get, because it can vary depending on how much your insurance costs. But you can have a variance of 20-25% quite easily. You know, they always say 15 minutes can save you 15% or more. Well, you may take more than 15 minutes, but you can often save more than that by switching to a company that can give you essentially the same thing at a lower cost.
Okay. Well, you know, we have a few calls right now, so let's go to the phones. RJ in Milwaukee has a question for you. Hi, RJ.
Hi. I was meeting with my son this morning, and he was talking about his car insurance, and he's going to be turning 25 in March, and he's also paid off his 2010 car. And he was under the impression that because of those two factors, his insurance rates might be able to go down. Have you had any experience with that?
You know, I think a lot of companies will drop the rates at 25. It's the point at which they think most of your youthful follies are behind you, and you know, you can maybe are better risk at that point. But again, companies are different, and I would certainly encourage him to, you know, not only check with his own company, but check with an independent agent or a captive agent from another company and see if they can give him a better deal, because everybody looks at the factors somewhat differently. And being 25, I think, is important, but it may be much more important to one company than another. I don't know that paying his car off would have a big effect. One thing he might want to look at is if the car is paid off, and depending on the value of the car, you know, you might look at whether do you need comprehensive coverage? Do you want to keep collision coverage? Collision coverage particularly can be real important, because that's the most likely thing to happen that causes a lot of damage to a car. But you should weigh those things and weigh the cost and decide what really makes sense to pay for when you've got a car that's not ancient. I see cars from 2005 and the 90s even still, but it's old enough, so you might take a look at what the value of the car is and what you're getting out of collision and comprehensive coverage.
Okay, well, thank you, RJ. Appreciate that call. Now, let's talk a little bit about what insurance we need for our cars, because we see all these numbers with slashes and all these terminology that it's kind of confusing. So what do we actually are required by law, and what do you think we should probably have?
Okay. You know, we start with liability coverages and in auto insurance generally, because those are in some ways the ones that you are much more likely to have a claim than you are on homeowners and other coverages. But in terms of auto insurance, Wisconsin requires $25,000/$50,000. And the slash always denotes the difference between 20. The first number is the most money your company will pay if you injure one person in an accident. The second number is the most money the company will pay for everyone who's injured in an accident. So even if there were five or six people injured, they wouldn't pay $25,000 apiece. They'd pay a total of $50,000. $25,50 is really inadequate. In this day and age, we see bills from emergency rooms that can run $25,000. If they end up doing MRIs and a bunch of scans after a serious accident, your bills can mount up rapidly. We see medical bills in excess of $100,000. We were talking before we went on the air about the terrible case where the little girl had her arm injured badly by a wolf. And in that case, her medical bills were $350,000. So, you know, you can't always buy insurance for the worst case scenario.
Sure.
And I understand that. But there are a couple things you can do. One, really, you should not have less than 100/300. So 100,000 per person, 300,000 per accident. It doesn't cost that much more. You know, going from 25,50 to 100, 300 doesn't multiply your cost by four times
at all.
And oftentimes people are paying more for their collision coverage or their comprehensive coverage than they are for their liability coverage, which, you know, doesn't make a great deal of sense. In that, if you don't have enough liability coverage and you get in a bad accident, I mean, any assets you have can be at risk. Now, you know, declare bankruptcy. If you don't have any assets, that may not mean a lot to you. But for anyone who does, it's really important to have an adequate amount of coverage. The other thing people with significant assets should always do is look at an umbrella policy. The umbrella, usually you have to buy 100, 300 for a base, and then you can buy an umbrella. And umbrellas are remarkably cheap, because the company's risk isn't really that you're going to end up in an accident that costs $500,000 or $1 million. Their risk is really you're going to end up in an accident and have to pay something. And so that's really what they price. And, you know, they look at risk and they know that most of the time they're not going to spend a lot of money on umbrella policies. They're not going to have to pay out.
So umbrella policies then are what?
Umbrella policies, it's kind of like what it sounds. It's a protection. You know, I think Travelers has the umbrella, but everyone writes umbrella policies. And what they really do is they kick in after your basic coverage. So we have a case right now where we settled with the underlying insurer, and now we're pursuing a claim against the umbrella policy. So once that $100,000 per person or $300,000 per occurrence is exhausted, then the umbrella policy steps in just as if that, you know, and takes care of anything up to the amount of the umbrella, which is usually a minimum of $1 million and can be $2 or $3 million. But, you know, it's an important coverage if you have significant assets. And that doesn't mean, you know, you have to be, I was going to say Rockefeller, but I guess Trump would be more appropriate now. Yeah. But I mean, you don't have to have that kind of money. If you have your home that you've paid that's, you know, mostly paid off, if you have other, you know, a lot of people have a second home and things like that, you really should have that to protect those assets.
Okay. And so the umbrella would cover auto. Would it also cover your home then too?
It does. It generally covers both auto and homeowners. Mm-hmm. One other thing about auto, and then we can talk a little bit about homeowners, but auto, one thing you really need is underinsured motorist coverage. And I know this gets to be a lot of jargon. Lawyers and insurance companies say UIM. UM is uninsured motorist.
Okay.
You should definitely have that, and that's required. But UIM, underinsured, isn't required. Uninsured takes care of you if somebody hits you and doesn't have any insurance. Then your own uninsured motorist carrier steps in just as if they were the liability carrier. And you should make sure you've got adequate uninsured motorists, too. And uninsured and underinsured are cheap. They are much less expensive than liability coverage. So everybody should at least look at those because they don't cost much and they can be really important. We had a case a few years ago where he had a wealthy farmer and his wife. He was killed. She was severely injured, and they had no underinsured motorist coverage. The kids that hit them had $5,100, and it was, you know, they had $3 or $4 million in damages, essentially none of them could collect $100,000. And they could have bought underinsured motorist coverage for probably $20 for the year. So it's something you should always look at, again, just to protect yourself. People go out, I see these cases, and they had a lot of liability insurance, but they had such limited underinsured. So in essence, they were protecting other people much more than they were protecting themselves, in a sense.
Yeah.
And it's really important to look at that coverage.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. Our guest today is Mike Riley. He's a Madison attorney and a partner in the Axley Law Firm. What questions do you have? It looks like our lines are all filled, and we're going to go back to the phones in just a bit. But if you have a question, you can always send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. We're going to be going right to the phones. We're talking about insurance with our guests today and law questions, too. But we'll go to Sharon in Mercer. Hi, Sharon. What's your question? Sharon, are you there? Sharon, are you there?
Yes.
Okay. What's your question for us?
Okay. Hi, Mike. My question is a little bit different than your last callers, but we bought a home in 05 as strictly vacation property, and of course at the time we had title insurance. We found out subsequently, we've lived here for a year, that our property is landlocked. We were given misinformation on where our property lines were, and I'm kind of wondering, why do you buy title insurance? And is there anything we can do at this point to resolve this with the title company?
Sure. Let me answer the first question first, and I'll give you what I can give you on the second one, but that's not my area of practice. I'm really a personal injury guy who deals with insurance a lot. I don't deal with property issues very often, but I can give you some thoughts on it. First of all, I guess the simplest answer, you buy title insurance because your bank won't give you a mortgage if you don't. I mean, they want to be sure that you're getting valid title to the property that they're financing. And even if you didn't have a bank involved, generally speaking, people would say it's a good idea. What title insurance does is tells you that the person who's selling you that property has the right to sell that to you, that they have valid title, that no one else has a claim on the property. And normally at a closing, you go to a title insurance company, and the title insurance company goes through everything to be sure that everything's taken care of. So if there's a mortgage of record, if there are liens, if there are things on the property, then they're supposed to take care of that and make sure that isn't so. Now, title insurance always has, and again, there are lawyers who know a good bit more about this than I do, but I can tell you this much. Title insurance says, yes, we have this person can convey valid title. Then they always have these little hedge words where they say, well, you know, subject to easements of record, da-da-da-da-da. You know, I would have thought if this was landlocked, they would have picked that up. But again, I can't pose as an expert on title insurance. I'd certainly go to the title insurance company and see what they can do. I would also say that generally speaking, and again, it's not some sort of absolute rule, nor I am by any means an absolute expert in this area, but usually you can't be landlocked. Normally there's some form of easement, and particularly, obviously, you have been getting access to the property for a long time. That often creates what they call an easement by prescription, which simply means there has been an easement to your property that's been used. Whether or not there was a legal easement that's been filed or recorded, there is an easement that's been created by your use and perhaps your predecessor's use of that means of accessing the property. So I don't know if somebody has now raised this. It sounds like perhaps they have. If they have, I'd certainly talk to a lawyer who does property work and see what he can tell you about, one, any redress you might have against the title company, but two, whether or not you can in fact say, look, we've got an easement because we've been using an easement for years here. So those are my thoughts on that.
Okay. Well, I hope that works out for you, Sharon. Thank you very much for calling. Let's go to, is it Mary Ellen in Milwaukee? Hi, Mary Ellen.
Good morning. My question has to do with the fact that I'm an elderly person and I need to hire a teenage son of a friend of mine to come into my house and lift some heavy things for me out to the garage. And there are quite a few things I really want him to do, and I'm wondering if my homeowner's insurance would cover him if he sprains his back or anything like that.
Well, it almost certainly wouldn't cover him if he sprains his back, but you wouldn't be liable for that either. The only concern you would have is if some condition of the house caused an injury to him. So if, you know, a step gave way, if something, you know, something fell off the eaves, all of which is really unlikely, obviously. But if something like that happened, then your homeowner's insurance, the liability part of that, would almost certainly cover you. But you're not, this isn't, he's an independent contractor. You don't have to provide workers' compensation coverage. And the fact that people often think if somebody's hurt on my property, I'm liable for that. You're not. I mean, you're liable only if, you know, you did something negligent, you know, by failing to maintain the property or failing to warn him that, you know, that third step is tricky and he better watch it. That's the only way you'd have any personal liability. The other thing is people, understandably, are concerned that, gee, you know, could I have some personal liability? People in those situations almost never bring lawsuits, and most lawyers aren't going to be interested. No lawyer would likely take a case where somebody sprained his back lifting things in your house, because there's not a case there. If they did, and if they contact you, you'd go to your homeowners, and they would almost certainly take care of it for you. But I really don't, I think people's perception of the risks that they have is often way out of proportion to what the actual risks of being sued are. In this case, I don't think you have anything to worry about.
Okay, thank you for the question, Mary Ellen. Do you have a question about insurance or a legal matter? Give us a call. We have some open phone lines. Our number is 1-800-642-1234, or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Let's go back to the phones, and we have John in Cambridge waiting. Hi, John.
Hi. I have a question about one person owning several cars, like let's say I wanted to drive one on for one part of the week and another one for a different reason and then another one on the weekends. How could I get a good rate? Most companies won't want to insure the person. They insure the cars.
No, you're absolutely...
I'm only going to be driving as a myself, never anybody else.
No, and I understand that, John. It's a good question. What companies do is they look at this and they say, okay, there are three vehicles, in theory, you know, yep, you might be only operating one, but we don't know that. And if you give somebody else permission, then maybe both vehicles are being operated at the same time. So we've got a bigger risk than we thought we had. The thing you can do, though, is, again, and I'd check with some different agents or check with some different companies, because if you tell the companies, they always ask about miles and how many miles you put on and what your use is. And that should be a factor. If you can say, look, this is what I do. The total miles I put on all these cars is 10,000, 5,000, 50, whatever it might be. But I certainly don't put 10 on each car. You know, I alternate use. They're not going to simply say, well, that's okay, we'll just insure one car. They will almost certainly insist that you insure all of them. You might also then, you need to look too and see, do I need all the coverages on all the cars? Because you can put the liability coverage you need. I mean, that's important. But, you know, comprehensive collision, again, depending on the car's value and the amount of use and what you think is the risk of being in an accident, you know, you may look at that and say, I don't really need the same amount of that on each of the cars. I don't need to pay for that on some of the cars. Maybe I don't need to pay for it at all. I mean, that's a personal decision, and there's obviously risk involved. But I think that's something that you can look at, that you can, again, discuss with an agent and see if there's a way to lower your rates, because I'm virtually certain that different companies would view that situation differently. The problem is, if you only insure one vehicle, policies all have what they call an owned uninsured vehicle exclusion, which essentially says, you know what, if you own more than one vehicle, we're going to cover you for the vehicle we insure, but we're not going to cover you for any vehicle we don't insure. So that's, you know, why you have to think carefully about what you want to do, because you almost certainly won't be able to buy a policy that covers one vehicle on Mondays and another on Wednesdays, but not both at the same time.
Okay. Thanks for the call, John. Let's go. Oh, we had someone that called in, and I'm not sure. Let's see here. I think it was about contracting, so it was similar to the person before. Yeah, Jim from Verona wants to know if it's necessary to have a contractor certificate of insurance for residential work if the owner has homeowner's insurance. So that kind of goes back to what you were talking about before.
Right. Generally, contractors are independent contractors. There's just that. That's a difference because they're not employees, which changes your relationship, and you don't have the same obligations. If an employee you have to buy insurance for, do things for, you have to specifically do workers' compensation cover. You don't need to do that for a contractor. I think in a lot of cases, the contractor, if the contractor does something wrong and that causes an injury, you're not going to be liable for that. It's not your negligence. You did nothing wrong. And it's hard to conceive in my mind of a situation where you could somehow be liable for something the contractor did wrong. So I don't think that's the problem. I'm also, again, you know, contractors are not my bailiwick particularly either, but I'm not so sure that insurance isn't designed to protect you against the possibility that the contractor will do a lot of damage. One thing you ought to understand when you hire a contractor is this. If a contractor does poor work, his insurance company's not going to cover that. And people often think they will, and they don't. Even contractors, I think, sometimes think they will, and they don't. They have an exclusion that's called work product exclusion that says we're not insuring the quality of what you do. We had a case not too long ago where a contractor improperly installed a chimney in an addition, and because of that, the whole house burned down. Well, that is covered because that was a negligent act on his part. It wasn't just the quality of the work. It damaged the other structure and it damaged other things. So there's a distinction there. But generally speaking, I don't think it's critical to you that there be a certificate of insurance from the contractor, at least in terms of any personal liability you might have.
Okay. Well, thanks for that question. Let's go to Andy, who emailed to ask about SR22 insurance that he's required by law to have until 2019 because of traffic offenses when he was younger. Is it possible to get that length of time reduced?
The answer is, I don't know. My guess is probably not. But what I would do is write Motor Vehicle or call Motor Vehicle and ask to talk to a specialist out there, because they certainly have people that know. The second thing I'd do is, there are a lot of insurance companies that act, or insurance agencies probably more than companies, that specialize in that SR22s. And you might go talk to one of the agencies as well. Now, you know, they may have a slight conflict because they'd like to sell you insurance. But, you know, I think most of them would be straightforward and tell you, look, there isn't really much you can do or you can. But I'd also call Motor Vehicle and say, I've got a question about SR22 and see what they can tell you.
Okay. Well, good luck with that, Andy. Let's go back to the phones. We have John calling in Milwaukee. Hi, John. What question do you have?
Hello?
Yes. What's your question, John?
My question was relating to shopping for lower rates and whether a lower rate has any consequence on service follow-up. There are companies that have generally higher rates, and my question is, does that lead to better service, or can one really shop and go for a lower rate and still have good protection?
Is there a correlation, Mike?
Not much, I think, is the fair answer. Look, there used to be really significant differences between companies, and I'm not suggesting there aren't still differences. I believe there are, but there used to be a handful of companies that I could, with good conscience, say, you know, you really should consider using this company and paying less. Those days are pretty much gone in my experience. We deal with a broad variety of companies. I'm not a big fan, frankly, of some of the companies like Geico that don't have any local agents generally and don't deal with you. I think that and when we settle a claim with them, you're talking to people in Macon, Georgia all the time as opposed to somebody local. But, you know, a lot of the companies that were really fine companies, including some local companies, have just gone to this model where service is not first and foremost. Profit is. And it doesn't mean that you won't get service. It doesn't mean there isn't any difference. But if you buy the same coverage, so if you buy 100,000, 300,000 liability coverage and the other coverages are the same, do I think there's a major difference in the way your company will react if there's an accident and you have to deal with that? I don't think there is a major difference. I think there can be some difference. Is it enough to offset the differences in price? Well, you know, that's kind of a personal judgment, but I would never say pay twice as much for insurance because you'll get twice the service. That's simply not true at all.
Okay, well, thank you for that. We're talking with Mike Riley today. He's a Madison attorney and a partner in the Axley Law Firm. Do you have any questions about insurance or the law in general? Give us a call. Our number is 1-800-642-1234, or you can always send an email to ideas@wpr.org. And we're going to go back to the phones, and we have Pam in Milwaukee who has a question. Hi, Pam.
Hi.
What's your question?
I have a 18, almost 19-year-old son living in a house. He did get his driver's license, but he is not driving any of our vehicles. Do we have to keep him insured? Do I have to keep paying his insurance, and how long?
Well, if he doesn't have a separate vehicle, you're paying for him under your insurance. Have you listed him as a driver?
Well, he has no vehicle.
Okay, but I mean, have you listed him as a driver on one of your vehicles or suggested to the company he might drive one of your vehicles?
Well, my agent says he has to be on a vehicle listed.
Well, you know, he doesn't have to be on the vehicle. I mean, I would disagree slightly. What the agent is saying is that the policy is going to cover him because he's a resident relative, and that's almost certainly true. Companies have definitions of their insured, who they're covering. And the first thing they say is you or your spouse. So you are the person whose name's on the policy, and your spouse is always included. Then they say resident relatives, which generally means people who are living in your house. If you have a kid who's away at school or doing other things, there's always a potential question about whether that's a resident relative. Most of the case law suggests somebody who's just gone for a while but will be coming back probably still is a resident relative, but you should think about all that stuff when you're buying insurance. The company is going to want the names of anybody else in the house who's of driving age, and they probably do have to list that. I think it's worth talking to a couple other agents to see if anyone else has a different solution. My guess is you probably have to have them on the policy, but certainly you should be able to tell the company that he's not driving. He isn't driving cars. We don't expect him to drive any of the cars. And if that's the case, I would think that some companies at least would take that into consideration in terms of your rate. Not all will, but some should.
OK, Okay, thank you for the call, Pam. Mike, we've been talking about cars, but let's switch gears a little bit and talk about homeowners.
Okay.
And we've all heard horror stories about homeowners who thought they were covered for replacement value or to replace it, but they weren't. Why don't you explain the difference between that?
Yeah, that it's really important. There are two different kinds of coverage. Most policies that I see are written for replacement value, which means if you have damage to your home or if you lose the home entirely in a fire, and look, that kind of thing is rare, but it does happen. We just watch it happen to a whole bunch of people, unfortunately. Whether those are insured or not may be a different view, but you should have replacement value because otherwise all you're going to get is the value of the house. So, you know, if it's a 34-year house, they're going to depreciate it. They're going to depreciate your roof. So if you have a roof that's 15 years old and that's damaged in a windstorm and has to be replaced, the company, if you don't have replacement, you have actual cash value, the company's going to say, well, the actual cash value of that roof is only, you know, instead of $20,000, which is what it's going to cost to replace, it's $5,000 because you've already used 15 of the 20 years of that roof's life. So it's really important to have the replacement value coverage. It makes, believe me, settling those things becomes a lot easier with replacement value than it is with actual cash value. The other thing is, you know, if you have a loss and you're looking at this, I've gotten involved. This is not really the focus of my practice. Mine is personal injury, but I've handled a number of these claims over the years. And I've had so many occasions where one company, a tornado goes through a neighborhood, damages a bunch of roofs and a lot of siding. I get three or four companies who step up and pay like that, pay to replace, and you'll get a couple who say, nope, that roof isn't, that's just cosmetic damage. You know, every other shingle being gone is cosmetic. I'm exaggerating, obviously, but they really are very, some companies and some adjusters, because there's a real difference from adjuster to adjuster within companies, are just a lot more difficult to deal with than others. So, you know, if that happens, that's the point. You should certainly try to just resolve this on your own. I don't like handling them simply because we do it on a percentage basis, and I don't want to take 25% of what someone's going to get to replace their roof because now they've got 3/4 of a roof, and that doesn't make a lot of sense. But, you know, I'd always work with the company directly. That's an area where I think an agent can be helpful to you on occasion, going back and saying, hey, guys, come on. You know, this person has been a great insured. They've got 10 other people in the block who had their roof taken care of. Why aren't we? But the bottom line is, if you can do it that way, that's great. Get the replacement coverage, go through the company, see what they can do. If you're not being treated fairly, there are options. You can talk to a lawyer. You can talk to there are people called public adjusters who actually help people adjust losses against insurance companies, generally property losses. So there are options that you can pursue if you're not getting what you need from your company.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. Let's go back to our phones, and we have Todd in Tomahawk up next. Hi, Todd. What's your question?
Hi there. I am an independent contractor, and I take care of a lot of properties for people up in northern Wisconsin. And most of my customers basically are very high-income people, and my insurance agent, you know, made the comment to me that if I bring on a subcontractor or a contractor to maybe fix the roof or remove the snow on the roofs of these clients of mine, and they happen to pay their employees, you know, their employee cash, and I don't know about it, or they don't have health insurance, and they fall off the roof and get injured, that my client's homeowner's insurance is going to get sued. Is that, you know, how do I make sure that these people are paying people on payroll? And is that true? Is my client, you know, at risk of getting sued for the injuries of someone being paid cash from another independent contractor that's on the property?
Yeah, I think it's highly unlikely that your client would be, for instance, the example you use, let's say somebody's up clearing snow on a roof and they slip and they fall. Well, you know, there's nothing that your homeowner did to cause that. I mean, they weren't negligent other than owning the home and the fact that it does snow and snow gets on the roof. They did nothing that's negligent. And that's really the key to most claims against people, is there has to be an act that shows less than average care. So they did something that wasn't appropriate that most people wouldn't have done or would have done to prevent this from happening. And that just doesn't apply in the vast majority of these situations. Now, if they're on the property and there's a problem, as I said earlier when we were talking to the lady, if there's a problem that you create on your property that then causes an injury, yes, you might be liable for that. But you know, it strikes me that what you're talking about is situations where it would be highly unlikely the homeowner's carrier would be responsible. From your standpoint, and again, I'm not an employment lawyer either, but generally speaking, you know, if you, these people are your employees, then you have obligations to them, including workers' comp coverage and things like that. If they're truly independent contractors, and in this case, it sounds like they're probably independent contractors twice removed, because they not only are not your employees, they're not even the employees of the independent contractor you hired. You could, you know, you should probably talk to someone who knows more about that than I do, but generally speaking, somebody's not an employee unless you have the right to control what they do, when they do it, how they do it. There are a bunch of tests. You can't just call someone an independent contractor when they work for you and no one else, and they have, when you say jump, they have to jump. That person probably isn't an independent contractor. But if the people you're hiring sound like they likely are, which means that there would be very limited exposure on your part. Again, I can't imagine how you could be responsible for them sending someone up on a snowy roof and being injured. So I think it's worth, you know, talking to your agent, but I'd probably go talk to a lawyer and get a little more detailed advice, because I don't think that that's a situation where particularly your homeowners have any exposure, and I'm not convinced you do either.
Okay, well, thank you for that question, Todd. Next up, we have Chris in Oconomowoc. Hi, Chris.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
You bet. What's your question?
So my wife and I were recently in a car accident in California, and we're dealing with insurance companies right now. And the other insurance company has recently accepted liability in the accident. However, the policyholder is proven to be underinsured for the property damage claim. So two questions. Who do I continue to seek recourse from, their insurance company or my insurance company, regarding property damage, including a diminished value claim? And also, is it beneficial for me to pursue the medical claim again with my own insurance company? I have MedPay for my family, or with the other insurance company?
Sure. Well, let's go backwards first. The medical payments coverage, you should do that with your own company, and the reason's pretty straightforward. If your company pays the medical payments, they can turn around and ask the other company to repay them for that amount. But if, in fact, if there are injuries, and there obviously were, there wouldn't be medical payments, and you recover for those injuries, you can generally get a better deal from your own carrier when you go back to resolve that. All that means is, let's say they paid $5,000 in medical payments coverage. If you know, we were the clients we represent in that situation, when we settle the claim, we would almost certainly get a reduction of, you know, $1,000, $1,500, maybe a little more than that, from the medical payments. So you wouldn't have to pay all of that back. You'd only pay a portion of it back. If the company on the other side pays it, they're going to subtract that out in full. They'll pay in full to begin with. They won't get as good a deal usually from the facility that provided the care. Most insurers, even MedPay coverage, often will get a deal and will pay at a little lower rate. There's a bunch of reasons why it makes more sense to go through your own MedPay to begin with. Plus, most cases, the other side, the liability carrier for the other person who caused the injury, won't make a partial payment until they're ready to settle the whole case. Most times they say, no, we're not going to do that until you're ready to settle. And you don't want to be pressured into settling. You want to wait until it's an appropriate time to settle. So use your own medical payments coverage. First, use your health insurance if you have it. Always use your own health insurance first, because they pay at a much lower rate generally, because they have deals with all these facilities. Then go to the MedPay coverage to take care of anything that isn't covered by your insurance, deductibles, co-pays, you know, some treatment that isn't covered, things of that sort. So that's the way to deal with that. Then let's go back to the property damage. That probably isn't covered under your underinsured. I'm assuming you're here in Wisconsin, so it's probably a Wisconsin policy that you have.
Yes.
Yeah, and usually Wisconsin law generally governs Wisconsin policies. Most of the underinsured policies I see do not include property damage. If yours does, that's great. Then I would certainly go right to them once the other side has paid, you know, the limits of what it has. And speaking of which, while we're on this subject, for everyone, you know, property damage limits used to routinely be $10,000. And even now I see a lot that are maybe $25,000. And boy, in a day when there are a fair number of people driving Teslas and other cars that cost $100,000, having $25,000 of liability coverage for property damage is probably not enough. It's a good idea to have more than that. And again, it's not terribly expensive to get more. The other thing I should say, just, you know, and this, we see this a lot, when you have an accident in another state, that state's statute of limitations, the amount of time you have to bring a claim, is going to be governed by that state's law, not by our law, for the most part, okay? The underinsured claim is almost certainly governed by our law because it's a Wisconsin policy and it's a policy claim. So, you know, people, the courts will say, look, that's a Wisconsin claim, the parties are here, the contract was entered into here, that's that. But in terms of bringing any kind of action against the person responsible for an accident in California, you need to know California law. And as I recall, California is one of those states that has a relatively short statute. Ours is 3 years generally. Theirs, at least on the liability claim, theirs, I think, could be as little as a year. At least it was some years ago when I had a claim out there. So it's worth checking on that, too, to make sure you don't lose your rights.
Okay. Well, Chris, that's complicated. I hope you can get that straightened out. Our guest today is Mike Riley. He's a Madison attorney and a partner in the Axley Law Firm. Do you have a question for him? We'd like to hear from you. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You are listening to The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. I'm sitting in for Larry today on the Ideas Network. We're talking to attorney Michael Riley, primarily about insurance, but we can talk about some other legal questions. And Mike, let's go straight back to the phones. We've got a lot of people waiting. Hi, Dennis in Pewaukee. What's your question?
Yeah, I just had a question. If a neighbor had a very large tree that you could see was dying, is there a way to work proactively through your insurance company to, you know, say, hey, can you take this tree down before it falls on my house to save everybody a lot of grief?
Sure. I think the best thing to do, and being proactive is a great idea, Dennis, is I'd go to the neighbor. I'd talk to him. I'd also write them a letter so it's documented and say, look, we're really concerned about this. This is clearly dying. You know, if this falls on our roof, you know, we're going to have to make a claim and our insurance company will come back against you, because they likely will. I mean, as long as you've got insurance, your company will probably take care of it. But if that happens, they would like to go back and collect the money from your neighbor's insurance if they could. And if you've got a letter that you've sent warning of this specific risk, I think that'd go a long ways to bolstering their claim. And hopefully what it'll really do is get your neighbor to do the right thing and deal with the situation now.
Mike, when you do a letter like that, should you have it certified so that there's proof, or isn't that necessary?
I don't think that's essential. I think sometimes it's a good idea simply because, one, you've got proof, but you also, I think it kind of ups the seriousness quotient. You know, when you get something that's certified, I think people go, whoa, you know, maybe I better take that seriously.
Yeah. Okay, great. Well, thank you for bringing that up, Dennis. I'm sure there's a lot of people that are in that same situation. Up next, we've got Pat in East Troy. Hi, Pat.
Hi, another tree question. Only mine are very healthy. They're very old. They're older than I am, and I am really old.
But, welcome to the club.
I have a rental house next door to the house that I live in, and it was built in 1946 with lumber that was not dried properly, so the ridge poles look a little saggy, and that may be the reason my insurance company says they will not insure the roof or anything that touches the roof and harms it. Also, there are two huge, old, healthy oak trees that, because the prevailing winds have shoved them one direction, look like they're kind of hanging in that direction, and if they came down, they would clobber the roof. What can I do? Is there a way of, and nobody will tell me what the reason is why they won't insure it. They just flatly say they won't insure.
Okay. Well, you know, that's a great question. And the first thing I'd suggest is, again, as we've said before, I'd go talk to an agent, probably an independent agent, maybe a couple of independent agents and some, just see if anyone's willing to write that. Because I can tell you, we had a problem. We have a cottage and we have a fireplace in the basement that hasn't been used since we bought the cottage 20 years ago and never will be used. And yet we had a couple companies say, well, we're not going to insure that because you have a fireplace. We don't use the fireplace ever. But we did find a company that would do it and would insure it and was willing to listen to us that we didn't use the fireplace. So, I mean, I'd at least make an effort to do that. I mean, if that roof just caves in, they're not responsible for that. I mean, insurance coverage isn't going to cover, you know, something just failing because the wood gets rotten or it's just very old and it fails. If a tree falls on it, that's a different thing. Then they would have to cover it. And they may be looking at this and saying, well, a lot of roofs, you know, a tree might, you know, a branch might fall and isn't going to do much here. If a branch falls, that may be it for the whole thing. But the best thing to do is shop. Talk to some other people. See if you can find someone else who's interested. Some companies are going to want to come out and have a site visit and view and everything. Other companies, frankly, won't. And so there may be plenty of companies who just, you know, they may ask you about the age of the roof, but they may not require pictures. They may not send somebody out to actually look at the property. So that's the first thing I do. Secondly, and this perhaps applies more to claims, but even in this situation, Wisconsin law under the Claims Practices Act, and this isn't a claim, it's a different situation, but under the Fair Claims Practices Act, if you have a claim and a company says no, they have to give you a complete explanation. And so if you're in that situation with a company, and again, this isn't your situation, but you should write the company and say, you know, you've denied coverage. We need to know, cite the specific policy language based on which you're denying coverage. Tell us any facts you're relying on to deny coverage, because sometimes companies are simply wrong. And sometimes if someone takes a second look, they'll say, oops, you know what, I guess we really do owe you this. But at any rate, then you understand what's going on. It's a lot easier to respond to it. In this case, it's a little tougher, Pat, because nobody's obliged to sell you insurance. I mean, there aren't any rules that say they have to sell you insurance or they have to cover a specific risk. So I think the best solution for you here is to look around and see if you can find somebody that will cover that.
And Pat, I have a wonder, you said that the roof might fail because of dry or green wood. Is that something that you had an inspector look at, or was that the insurance company?
Oh, it's been inspected and re-roofed many times. It was just the situation in 1946 when my father built this house out of three prefab garages from Sears. that was the only material you could get in 1940.
Sure, sure. But they said that was the reason why. I mean, it's not
stable. It's held up perfectly ever since 1946.
Hmm.
So I am objecting to their objecting.
Yeah. Better shop around, Pat.
I wish I could say I'd held up perfectly since 1946.
Okay.
Anyway, I think that's the best idea, Pat.
All right. Well, hopefully that'll work out for you, Pat. Thanks for calling. Let's go to Sherry in Stoughton. Hi, Sherry.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was wondering if I give, like, my neighbors rides and I drive their car, I don't know what kind of insurance they have. So if they don't have enough, like, would my own insurance cover that since I have insurance?
It's so nice to be able to get a simple answer. Yes.
Yes. Wow.
It will. Here's what happens. If you're in an accident when you're driving someone else's car, the car insurance is always primary. Your personal insurance is secondary. So in most cases, you don't get to combine coverages. You do in that situation. So if I let somebody use my car and they're in an accident, my insurance would pay first. And then if I didn't have enough insurance, their own insurance would step in. So your insurance will take care of you. And so as long as you've got enough, whether they do or not, probably doesn't matter much.
Okay. Thanks for the call, Sherry. Kind of a follow-up on that, Mike. You know, lots of us go on vacation and we rent a car. Do we need to buy the insurance when we rent a car, or will our insurance company cover that?
Well, your insurance company, it's always good to, one, look at your policy, and two, since you probably would have difficulty understanding the policy since they are unusually, you know, unnecessarily complex.
Right.
But talk to your agent and ask your agent specifically. A lot of credit cards will cover. I mean, in terms of liability coverage, your insurance will almost certainly cover you. So purchasing separate liability insurance. You know, if the rental company's charged a reasonable price for any of the insurance, I'd say just buy it. But, you know, I don't generally buy it myself because the price is just outrageous. I once had a guy from the companies tell me, it's okay. It's, you know, you don't have to worry. It's really inexpensive. And I said, it's like $800 a month. Nobody's paying $800 a month for car insurance. And so generally speaking, your liability coverage should take care of you. But again, it's always worthwhile verifying that with your agent or directly with the company. In terms of damage to the vehicle itself, that's a bigger concern. And there are varying answers. If you're using a lot of credit cards will take care of that damage. I had some fairly minor damage to a car, which wasn't my fault, but I would have had to pay. But I used my American Express card, which did cover it. So do a bunch of other cards. You can, again, check with the company and see what's covered. Make sure you know, understand. If you're using a car for a day and it costs $7 to get that insurance, I think it's worth it for peace of mind. When you're renting a car for a week or two, it gets really expensive. And you shouldn't, if you don't need it, you shouldn't be paying for it. And I think in most cases, you don't.
Okay. Well, we've got a short time here. Let's go to Rick in Colfax. Rick, you got a quick question for us.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Yes, I was wondering if you could tell me if there's a way that I could find out information about the insurance company that I use to insure my house. The reason I'm asking is because a friend of mine had a house fire here a while back, and it took him, I don't know, a long time and much frustration to get his house put back together. And I've been with my company for actually many years here, and I've never had a claim, but how do I just make sure that this company is good?
Okay, well, thank you so much for the question, Rick. We're going to have to wait until after the news to come back and get that answer from Mike. We've been talking with Mike Riley. He's a Madison attorney and a partner in the Axley Law Firm. Do you have a question about insurance? Well, give us a call. 1-800-642-1234. News next. We're talking about legal issues on the show today. This is Jill Nadeau. I'm filling in for Larry Mueller today. It's great to have you along on the Ideas Network. Our guest is Mike Riley. He's a third-generation Madison lawyer and a partner in Axley Law Firm. What legal questions do you have? Join the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to our email address, ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on our Facebook page. And just a reminder, our discussion today is intended as general information and should not be relied on or construed as legal advice. Okay, Mike, well, let's go right back to the phones. They're all filled up. We've got Rick in Colfax. Hi, Rick. Oops, actually, Rick just disappeared.
Well, you know, we should answer that. We didn't answer
right.
The question.
Thank you for being on top of things, not like me. So
No,
go right ahead. Get that answer for Rick.
Well, so I think Rick wanted to know, you know, how can he tell if his company's a good company?
Right.
And probably the answer is, well, just wait till you have a claim and you'll find out.
That's not helpful, Mike.
What he wants to hear.
Yeah.
You know, there aren't a lot of great answers to that. I mean, the basic answer is that I think the differences between companies were much greater 20 years ago than they are now. I think all companies have become more difficult to deal with. I mean, I deal with them on a daily basis, and some are likely better than others. There's also a lot of variability even within a company, depending on which adjuster is handling your claim. Some of them really make an effort to be helpful. Some of them are very nice people. Some of them, frankly, are not such nice people and don't make much of an effort to be helpful. So if you want to see generically how to see, one, the Office of the Commissioner of Insurance keeps track of complaints. So you can contact them, probably go online and get information about which companies get the most complaints. You know, are there companies that just traditionally have had problems? I mean, without wishing to stigmatize, Allstate traditionally has been a tough company to deal with. But there are a number of others. They're not alone. And I would say that the industry as a whole has swung more towards where Allstate was than Allstate swung in the other direction. So, you know, there isn't an easy way to do that. Again, I think besides going to the Office of Commissioner of Insurance, you know, talk to an agent. I mean, agents represent multiple companies. Now, you know, they may get a bigger commission from one company or their results may give them better money from one company than another. But the fact is, I think most independent agents will be able to tell you if they've had a good experience. And most independent agents want to keep the business they get. So they're not going to put you with a company that they're pretty sure is going to make you real angry if you ever have a claim. They're going to try to get you with someone who they think will keep you happy so they can keep earning commissions from your premiums. So I think those are the two things that I would suggest. Neither of them are a magic solution, but I think it's the best I could offer.
Okay. Well, let's go back to phones. Andrew in Wausau has been waiting. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, how's it going? Thank you for taking my call.
You bet. What's your question?
I was just curious. We went on vacation one time, and we left a friend of mine to watch the house. And while we were gone, the house, there was a fire. And when the fire department came, the guy who was watching my house said he had had a cigarette in the morning. And they thought maybe it was because of the cigarette, but the fire didn't start till like 1 o'clock in the afternoon. So, but anyway, long story short, we got the claim through. It took forever, like the previous caller was saying, it took forever to get the house done. But after it was all said and done, next thing I know, the insurance company is going after my friend for the $26,000 in damage. So my question is, what, because we don't actually want the insurance company to go after him because, A, I don't think he was negligent, and, B, we could all vouch, like, the entire family could vouch for him, you know what I mean? And I was wondering if there is a way to, like, stop that or deter it or...
Well, to begin with, it's a great question because insurance companies, when you have a claim against you, really don't care what you think. They might care if there's some risk that they'll have to pay more money because, you know, the claim might exceed your coverage and they don't do the right thing in trying to settle it. But the days when companies were concerned about what their insureds want are long gone. I have an uncle who was an insurance defense lawyer, and I am a guy who represents people who are hurt, and we were working on a claim, and he said to me, well, Mike, the insured really doesn't want to see it settled. And I said, you don't pay any attention when they want it settled. Why would you care now? And he said, you're right, we'll pay. So, you know, that you just don't have a lot of control. Now, I think the one thing your friend can do and that you can do with him is to say, look, if they're all you've got is the fire department saying this is a possible cause, that's not enough. I mean, they're not going to succeed in a claim against him based on the theory that he smoked a cigarette at some point, and there's no evidence that that is the point of ignition for the fire. So, you know, it may be that this is something where they're just writing him hoping, you know, that he will pay, or more properly, his company. If he doesn't have insurance, I'd make that clear to him because obviously he's probably not going to be able to pay anyway. If he does have insurance, then he should immediately turn that over to his homeowner's insurance company and let them deal with it so that at least he doesn't have to face, you know, the nightmare trying to deal with the company on his own. Ultimately, if he doesn't have insurance and if they're going to pursue this, he really should talk to a lawyer and see if he can get somebody to help him with this, because my sense is, based on what you said, that the evidence that he caused this fire is really weak. And if that's the case, I think the insurance company might back down fairly quickly.
All right. Thank you for the question, Andrew. Let's go to Owen and Wanawika.
Wayawiga.
Wayawiga, thank you.
I probably missed it too, but I think I was closer.
Owen, what's the correct pronunciation?
Wayawiga.
There you go. A plus, Mike. What's your question, Owen?
Thanks for taking my call. Okay, so I'm an employee on a dairy farm here in Wisconsin,
okay.
And I've written some letters to the Secretary of Agriculture's office there in Washington, D.C., Sonny Perdue, and I've written letters here to Governor Walker. I've written letters to some other constituents of mine here, you know, the congressmen and assemblymen here, and gotten basically passed along and no real answers given. And I think I've got a pretty good legal claim to what I'm trying to convey. And I'm wondering, is there, because I don't make a lot of money, I make about $25,000 a year, is there a legal aid organization that specializes in helping agricultural employees who don't have a lot of assets to try to work with a federal type of jurisdiction?
Yeah, that's a great question. I wish I had a great answer, but I don't. I think what I would try is there's a lawyer referral service through the State Bar of Wisconsin. So if you look up State Bar of Wisconsin, that's And none of us believe it's because lawyers spend much time in bars for some reason that's called the Bar Association for Lawyers. At any rate, you know, look that up. And there's something that's called the Lawyer Referral Service. And if you send that in and ask them the question, they may be able to get somebody who'd be able to help. There's lots of legal assistance programs, you know, for criminal matters. There really are many fewer for civil matters. The other place I'd try is the University of Wisconsin Law School has some programs, and it might be that somebody there either could help with this or could point you in the right direction to get help.
Okay, thank you, Owen, and good luck with that. Next up is Gary from Sun Prairie. Oh, I made a rhyme. Oh, what's your question, Gary?
Hi, my question was, I'd like to take a job with another company where I would be driving people to and from hospital appointments, and they called me a subcontractor. When I went to my insurance company and said, here's what I'd like to do, they said, okay, you've got to have a commercial policy, which goes from like $800 a year to $4,000 a year. Other people that are driving for the company said they've never heard of such a thing. Does that sound right, that I'd have to get a commercial policy for something like that?
No, it doesn't. I mean, I don't think that's not a commercial driver's license. Would you have to get a CDL to do that? I don't believe so. I used to drive cab years ago, and I know we didn't need anything very special. Otherwise, I would never have been driving cab if you needed anything very special, given my history at that point. But the bottom line is, I'd talk to another insurance agent, see what they can tell you. You know, there's plenty of good independent agents in town, and I'm sure, you know, you are in our area. So I check on that because, again, companies just view these situations differently. It may be that you are going to have to pay more. One thing you want to be sure is that if you're doing that, you're an independent contractor, there are some exclusions for business use under some circumstances. You want to be sure you're covered. But I'd talk to an agent because I can't believe all companies are going to say you got to pay that kind of money to drive people to and from the hospital.
Okay, thanks for the question, Gary. Joel in Middleton, you're up next.
Hi there.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, speaking of rent cars, I rented a car for a week. I reserved it for a week online using an online site, and they sold insurance, collision damage, with the rental. And as it turns out, you have to prepay for the entire duration of the rental period. And I only used the car for 2 of the 8 days. Now, the rent car company, of course, they charge after the fact. The insurance company tells me they don't give refunds. And they will not refund the unused portion of my insurance. And can they do that?
Well, they may be able to. It depends on what the contract says, and that is a matter of contract. I mean, there isn't some independent rule that says they can do this but not this. I do a couple things. One, did you say Travelocity? Is that who you went through?
Yes, that is who I went to. Travelocity refers me to Aon, the insurer. Aon refers me back to Travelocity.
Yeah,
I contacted the insurance commissioner's office, and I have not heard anything from them. I did get a letter from Aon basically restating everything that they said to me on the phone, that they don't do refunds. Now, what they said was on trip insurance, but this was not trip insurance.
Well, what I do is write back and point that out to them. I'd also talk to, we have consumer protection in Wisconsin, usually through the Department of Agriculture, and you might want to talk to them to see if they can be of some help, because this is obviously a consumer issue, even though it also deals with insurance. You know, the problem with the Office Commissioner of Insurance used to be a great resource. They used to be very helpful. Unfortunately, in my experience in recent years, they've been far less helpful than used to be the case. Used to be able to go to them, and they would get themselves involved and really take affirmative steps where it was appropriate. Now what happens is the company writes back and says it's a matter of contract, and you get a letter back from the Office of Commissioner saying, well, this is a matter of, there's a contractual dispute, and we can't get involved in those. So I wouldn't discourage people from filing a complaint, because I think it reflects on the insurance company, and it may be of some help, but I wouldn't hold my breath waiting for a lot of help from OCI in these days. I'd try that. I'd go back to, I know that you got kicked over to Aon from Travelocity. I'd go back to Travelocity and say, I didn't book this through Aon. I booked it through you. I relied on you. I relied on your reputation. I assumed that I'd be treated fairly, and I'm not, and I expect you to do something. Will they do it? Who knows? They may not, but I think it's worth taking that shot, too.
Okay, could he possibly go through his credit card company?
You might be able to, but I think the answer you're going to get from the credit card company is probably, that's a good idea, certainly, is to try to dispute the charge to the credit card company. I think that's an excellent idea. I just don't know what they'll do. I know there are things they will do and things they won't. And, you know, they do a lot of business, I'm sure, with Travelocity, but it's certainly worth trying that. I think trying all those things is worthwhile, and hopefully at least one of them will produce a result.
Okay, thank you so much for that question, Joel. I hope you get that figured out. Next up is John in Green Bay. Hi, John.
Yes, hi. I have 160 acres, all wooded in northern Wisconsin, and I have a party that wishes to lease it during the hunting season, probably up until, I suppose, the end of January. And I was wondering the best way to protect myself. I don't know if my homeowners would cover something like that. Any help would be appreciated.
Sure. It probably would. Is this property's included in your homeowners? Probably, but it, you know, it's not. You don't have a structure on it, I suppose, or do you?
No, there's no structure on it.
Okay.
It's all wooded.
So, and you don't insure that property either, I assume, because why would you? It's just woods.
Yeah.
Okay. Woods. Yeah. Well, you know, first of all, I'd want to take a good look at your policy and see exactly what the policy says. I mean, normally my answer would be yes, I think your homeowners would cover it. I also think that the risk is really very small. I mean, if you look at situations, let's say somebody's hunting on your land and they're shot. You know, one of the parties shoots someone else or somebody fires from, and I've handled a number of those cases over the years. If that happens, are you going to be liable? No, you didn't do anything wrong. I mean, you didn't create a hazard. You didn't, you know, leave the property in a condition that was unsafe. The property is the property. It's woods. You walk along through them. If something happens because somebody trips over a tree, for instance, and falls, you're not going to be liable for that. That just is not going to create a liability. Now, the odd thing is this, is that if you just said to your friends, you want to use the land? Go ahead. You'd have no liability at all in all likelihood because we have what's called recreational immunity in this state, which was initially sold as the Hunters and Snowmobilers Access Act, which was intended just to do that, to say people want to let somebody snowmobile on their land, they want to hunt on their land, something happens, they're not responsible, you know, period. They just can't be liable for that. The question is, there is a provision that talks about charging admission. I don't think this is the same thing as charging admission, but what I would say is this, is I will either send me an email or give me a call, and I'll take a quick look at work and see if I can sort out what the recreational immunity statute's going to do for you here. In a lot of cases, that would be a complete shield. It may or may not be here because someone's actually paying you for the use of the land. But again, as we said early on, look, it's wise to be cautious. It's wise to protect yourself. Most people are just much more concerned about risk than is probably warranted, because the notion that people are suing everybody every day, I do this for a living. I can assure you we're not. You know, we don't take cases we don't think are good cases. Lawyers aren't out chasing cases where there's very questionable possibility of you being responsible. So I think your risk is very small. But if you want to give me a call, is it okay if I'll give you my office number, 608.
Sure.
608-257-5661. Just ask for me, Mike Riley, and I'll see if I can get you an answer, okay?
All right. Well, thank you for that question. We're talking with Mike Riley, and he is an attorney here in Madison and a partner in the Axley Law Firm. If you've got a question, we do have open lines. The number is 800-642-1234, and you can always send an email to ideas@wpr.org. And we have Paul on the line, and Paul is in Middleton. Hey, Paul.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. So I entered into a home improvement program that's, the money comes from the county, but it's administered by a third party, and they help you find the contractor and everything. So this contractor started work on my house a year ago now, and it was evident about a month in, and he just was not paying attention to what he was doing. The work was really bad. He wasn't installing the things that were specified. So I fired him. He has just been hanging around for the last 6 months trying to find a way to not be held responsible for the things that the damage he caused my house. that's been resolved, but now I'm trying to pay him for the things that he completed correctly and get a resolution, and he's refusing to sign anything saying that I owe him more money because of the stuff that he started that wasn't completed as per the contract. So I'm wondering if I have any recourse to deal with the situation and get him to sign a resolution.
Well, there's a couple possibilities. One is probably the simplest, is send him a letter with the check, put right on the check in full and final settlement. You can make it clear in the letter that you're offering this in full and final settlement. If he doesn't accept it, there'll be no payment. And that's that. And then if that still doesn't do it, you know, the next option, I mean, you can file a lawsuit. How much is at stake? I mean, how much is he owed? You know, he may think he's owed more, but what kind of range are we talking?
I think he is saying about $7,000, and then I'm offering to pay him for what's completed, which is about $2,800 of that.
Okay. Well, that you could deal with in small claims court in all likelihood. So if you can go down to the city county building, get a summons and complaint, fill it out, just say we have this dispute, you know, that and ask for what's called a declaratory judgment, just asking the court to say, determine what you actually owe him. And they've raised the limit on that, except for insurance companies, for reasons known only to the insurance companies and the legislature. But the limit now is $10,000 for most cases. So, you know, even the $7,000 would be within that limit, and obviously the $2,800 is. And if he doesn't accept the check for $2,800, again, make sure it says right on the check in full and final settlement, and the letter says that as well. And again, suggested earlier, probably doesn't hurt to send that certified is a good idea. Jill mentioned that earlier, and I think that's a good idea. But that's what I do.
Okay, well, that sounds like kind of a nightmare. Maybe you can sell the rights to a movie, because that would be interesting.
Well, in this day and age, you just hope he doesn't show up with a gun someday.
Oh,
you know,
gosh,
just,
yeah, don't even want to think about that.
Jill, let me make one quick point, just because it's something I think is important, and we haven't quite gotten to it.
Sure.
But that's fine. But, you know, if you're in a dispute with an insurance company, particularly if you have a claim and you know, you either, particularly with an injury claim, because it often takes quite a while before you really know, you know, what's entailed in your injury. And what happens a lot is people will have a claim. Companies will come in and they always want to pressure you to settle early because they get out cheaper if they settle early. And oftentimes they'll come and they'll say, look, we'll pay for all your medical bills and we'll give you another $1,000 or $1,500 when maybe ultimately the claim is worth a lot more than that. People always want to believe they'll get better, and a lot of people do, and that's great. But a significant portion end up with longer term problems, and you don't want to settle a case before you really know where you're going to be and what your claim should be worth.
Okay. And let's take a quick question here from Paul in Middle. I'm sorry, that was Paul before. Let's go to Robert in Prairie Farm. Robert, quickly, we only have about a minute left. Robert?
Yeah.
Yeah, just quickly.
My wife was in Madison about 3 weeks ago visiting our daughter, and she tripped on a sidewalk in the city there, and it resulted in ambulance call and hospital visit. And,
okay.
And the insurance company, you know, they send questionnaires and want to know, well, who was at fault? If it wasn't an auto accident, if it wasn't at work, who was at fault for this accident? So
we're running out of time. Let me give you a real quick answer. The answer is the city may be at fault, but it's almost impossible to pursue those claims. They're very, very difficult. You'd have to show that there was a significant defect in the sidewalk and that the city knew about it and didn't do anything about it. So, you know, I would just tell the company, if you want to say anything, I'd just say she tripped on a sidewalk and let them draw their own conclusions. I doubt they'll ever pursue the city.
Okay. Well, thank you for being here, Mike. We really appreciate it. Lots of great advice, as usual. I want to thank our executive producer, Michelle Johnson, our on-air producer, Louisa DeVogel, and, of course, to Dave Potraz for his technical direction. Larry's going to be back tomorrow, and we've got Garden Talk with Vijay Pandya, and we're going to talk about controlling buckthorn. Always a great topic. I'm Jill Nadeau. I'm sitting in for Larry Mueller today. I want to thank you so much for listening to the Ideas Network. Stay with us, because there's always more to come.